This is a podcast for Monday, February 13th, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. And we just had an announcement that the Philosophy Club is meeting 6 o'clock northwest corner of the cafeteria, 6 to 7 p.m. Very first meeting, talking about officers, future club events, organization, and all that good stuff. Okay, so today we start on Kant. So the chapter is entitled The Kantian Synthesis for a reason. So you may have been frustrated in going through both the rationalist and the empiricist. You might think, well, I kind of like some of the stuff Descartes is doing, but it seems too extreme. It seems like the senses are really important. Maybe they're not everything, but it seems like the senses are important. And then you come to the empiricist and you say, okay, yeah, the senses are important, and the empiricist recognizes, but then it seems like they're also kind of like extremists on the other side. You think, well, couldn't I just have a view that sort of combined the best of both of them? And I think essentially that's what you get in Kant. So Kant actually started out as a Cartesian-type rationalist, and then he read David Hume. And he says that Hume, quote, awoke me from my dogmatic slumbers. In other words, he thought you could do philosophy like Descartes thinks, as a series of a priori deductions without using your senses at all. And he realized after reading Hume that there are a lot of problems with this, that you can't deduce facts about reality simply by closing your mind and sort of thinking about ideas, which is the Cartesian method. It's all conceptual. You just think about various concepts and how they're related to each other, and you come up with all the facts of reality. And that's, you know, Descartes is really taking a page from Plato, who did the same sort of thing, and saw philosophy as all conceptual analysis, and the senses are either they play a minor role, or they're even actually a negative, they're misleading. And so Kant tries to combine elements of both rationalism and empiricism until you get what is typically known as a synthesis, where you have a new view which combines the best elements of two other views, and you have something which sort of isn't exactly one or the other, isn't exactly kind of a mixture, but it's something completely new that combines elements of both. And this comes from Hegel, who, I think Hegel is, what do I say about Hegel? Can I say anything good about Hegel? Hegel's the guy that came up with thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
So you get one view over here, you get its, so we'll say rationalism. Another view over here, empiricism. So it's the opposite. And then the two combine and you get a synthesis, which is essentially Kant or Kantianism. There is no sort of name for Kant's philosophy because it's all, Kant's the one who created it. So sometimes it's just called Kant or Kantianism. And there's no, I don't know of any other way of describing it, just because Kant sort of has become the icon for this philosophy. Just like, I suppose, like Plato's a rationalist. So Kant or Kantianism. And so the Kantian philosophy and Kantian epistemology incorporates both rationalism and empiricism. And this is this thesis antithesis from Hegel. Take a political analogy. I just want to use this just because I think people are sometimes they're familiar with this. So you get this sort of idea of a liberal.
Up there, it's rather good.
The liberal political philosophy, the conservative political philosophy. So again, thesis. Antithesis, and then you get sort of these two philosophies clash, and then the But in the 1970s, you get the libertarian view, at least in American politics. And of course, this stuff goes on and plays out in a lot of different ways, so I don't want to make it sound like the libertarian philosophy is something that's completely new. Because you might argue that the libertarian philosophy goes back to, you know, Adam Smith and David Hume. It's really the original conservatism. But you get in America, you have this sort of the liberals are the fiscally insane and socially tolerant. I don't want to say the word liberal. And then you get the conservatives who are fiscally saner, maybe. And then socially, I don't want to use the word intolerant, but, and what's another word of the conservative? Somebody want to give me a good sort of, what would the conservative, the what's that?
Socially prudent.
Yeah, prudent's not really the right word. People that say, you know, there's a traditional or
rigid.
I like that word. Rigid. I won't go into the article I saw the other day about repressed conservatives cruising for gay encounters in D.C. during the CPAC, Conservative Political Action Committee. Or you can find that on the internet. I might find it entertaining. So you get these two views. So on financial issues, the liberals say, spend to oblivion, a trillion here, a trillion there. We have plenty of money, we'll just soak the rich. But then they say, if you're gay, you want to get married, if you want to, what are some other traditions? Gay marriage, reproductive rights. But the socially tolerant thing says that, the government shouldn't tell you who you can marry, what you do in your bedroom. Your private life is your own. What's that?
Pro-choice.
Yeah, they're pro-choice when it comes to abortion. And then you have and also the liberals are for...
drug use?
No.
but they'd be for drug...
medical, it's for purpose now.
Stem cell research, right? So and then the conservatives say, you have economic freedom. They believe in free market capitalism, but they think the government has some role to play in trying to support traditional marriage and trying to encourage people to be upright and moral in supporting religious morality in its various forms and so on. And so you get a synthesis of the two in the libertarian view, which is... fiscally sanist, or at least it, which means fiscally, you could say fiscally conservative and socially liberal. So you combine the best of both in the opinions of some. So in other words, you don't spend yourself... I mean, one way of looking at it, the libertarian view, I suppose, is you're consistent, and you say limited government across the board. The liberals want to control, how much salt you have in your food and whether you can eat trans fat, and they want to hit you with sin taxes if you want to smoke cigarettes, and they want to preach at you about, exercising, and then they want to take away all your economic choices where you're spending paying most of your money to the government, and then you get to keep what's left. But if you want to, have sex with a person of the same sex, or, march down in a big parade where you're whipping your boyfriend, or run around, throw condoms in the air, that's your constitutional right. You want to burn a flag and lock yourself out. That's what America's all about, burning flags. Whereas the conservatives say, you get to keep all of your hard-earned money, but the government should censor pornography on the internet, and you can't have your gay marriage, and so on. So anyway, the libertarian says, hey, knock yourself out, do what you want as long as you're not hurting anybody else. And you get to keep all your money, too. And they agree with the liberals on, you know, spending a bunch of money on war. And they agree with the conservatives that we shouldn't spend a bunch of money on social programs. That should be that if a person is able to work, they should work. If they fall in hard times, there's charity for that person. Anyway, this is probably a long-winded example here. And maybe a preview of what we might talk about in contemporary moral issues if you're looking for a class. That's Philosophy 205 next term. Anyway, the same idea is that you get two, you know, people think, oh, liberal, conservative, opposite sides. I don't know, the liberals, they seem like, the liberals, they seem really crazy, but the conservatives, they're even more crazy. And I can't think of so there's like a religious fanatic that wants to preach at me, but says I can keep all my money, Or there's this Marxist who says that he's not going to tell me how to live my personal life. Well, what kind of choice is that? And so you see like this sort of synthesis between the two views that say that you should be able to keep your money and live your personal life as you see fit. And that's the libertarian view, which is all about liberty. So anyway, in the same way here in Kant, you have rationalism that says reason and logic, a priori deductions, and a priori philosophy is all a priori. It's all logic. It's all conceptual analysis. And the senses play no role at all. And then you have empiricism, which says it's all the senses. It's all a posteriori. And that reason and logic, they just sort of take all the data of the senses and kind of like organize them in a certain way. And you end up with both these views end up with sort of strange consequences. You end up with Descartes, where your mind and body are these completely separate substances, trying to explain how they interact. You end up with extreme empiricism. You end up with views like Berkeley and Hume, where you don't know that the material world exists, where you don't know that you have a mind, where you can't prove cause and effect. And so to reject those consequences, Kant says you can sort of steer a middle course. And this is probably best understood in the grid on page
151.
So there, if you look at Hume, so Hume says that if you think about two terms, and these are two terms I have to introduce here, analytic and synthetic. And then there's a priori and a posteriori. So what do a priori and a posteriori mean again?
Pre and post-sensory information.
Yeah, so
it's like something that's inherently known. Yeah, independent senses.
Yeah, I should have put over here innate ideas. Okay. So a priori means it's done without aid of the senses. So the senses might play some role in that, you know, you're looking at a chalkboard and maybe you're to keep track of everything because you can't remember it all, you're putting little marks there. But your senses aren't really playing a role. That's just some abstract symbols you might have to write to keep everything straight. But really, when you're doing mathematics, when you're doing logic, it's not coming from the senses. You don't do an experiment to see whether a mathematical problem is true or to find a solution for it. And the same thing with logic. You don't if all men are mortal and if Socrates is a man, therefore what follows?
He dies.
Socrates is mortal, right? He's going to die. So if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. And you wouldn't like do an experiment to see, okay, well, if you really knew all men are mortal and you knew Socrates was a man,
you wouldn't like try to do a survey and say, okay, excuse me, sir, could I have a moment of your time? Are you a man? You know, yes. You know, are you mortal? Okay, shoot him. Okay, you shoot the guy, he dies, and you know, okay. Oh, no heartbeat, respiration. He's mortal, right? Okay, check one off. Let's kill a million more and see what happens, right? You'd say, okay, so you wouldn't do an experiment to confirm that. And deductive argument means that an argument is deductively sound if the premises are true, the conclusion is true. Or you go in a deductively valid argument. Let's just stick with the deductively valid argument. So if it's a deductively valid argument, if the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. And it's like this, if you know 2 + 2 = 4, then you also know, and you know,
4 × 3. Yeah, actually, maybe I need a better example here.
If you know certain things like the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, you can eventually prove, and a couple of other things, you can eventually prove the Pythagorean theorem that the a squared equals b squared equals c squared, right, from your geometry. You start out with certain axioms, and you know that if you have a right angle here, that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. And you can prove this just by taking certain basic theorems about geometry. Now, this isn't intuitively known, but other things like the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, or the interior angles of a triangle are equal to 180 degrees. You can sort of go through various geometric theorems. Eventually, you can prove that's true. And again, you don't have to do any experiments. You don't have to look at temperatures and pressures. You don't have to make observations. You don't have to mix some chemicals together. You can just do this with a chalkboard and thinking about concepts. So, and you're not out there with like a ruler saying, okay, if we get these units this certain way, then we're going to like measure the hypotenuse. You can just prove that it's true deductively. So, a priori reasoning. And Descartes thinks you should be able to do philosophy like you do math, like you do geometry, just by thinking about ideas. The empiricists say no, you have to do a bunch of experiments. You can't just think about ideas. You need to use your senses and scientific experiments to figure things out. What Kant says is that it's sort of a mixture of both. And to describe this, he makes a distinction between analytic and synthetic. So an analytic statement... What is an analytic statement? These terms will be on the exam, by the way.
Circle is round.
Okay, a circle is round. That's an example of an analytic statement. What defines an analytic statement?
It kind of it defines itself in its...
The predicate is...
Definition is in its word, inherent in its words.
And the word. The predicate gets contained in the subject. Right, so the predicate is round, circle. So a circle is round. Is round is part of the definition of a circle. A circle is a figure.
Is a shape.
It's a shape. It's a line whose points are made up of a line. It's a line whose points are equidistant from a central point or something. I don't know what the trying to remember the sort of strict geometric definition of circle. But it's true that's a quality of a circle. The circles are round. So a circle is round is part of the concept of a circle. So if you understand what a circle is, you know the predicate is round is true. So just by knowing what a circle is, you know the statement is true. The predicate sort of hiding the subject. An easier one might be a triangle is a three-sided figure.
Well, if you know what a triangle is, you know the predicate is a recited figure applies to, because that's just part of the definition of a triangle. So when you say the word triangle is a three-sided figure, sort of hiding inside the subject, the predicate is contained implicitly in the subject. The same thing. How about this? God is a perfect being. Right, going back to Descartes. If you think about this, what God is supposed to be, that's part of the definition of God, right? God is a sort of ultimate being. You think about the idea of God making mistakes, having something unexpected happen, right? Part of the concept of God is that he's a perfect being. He isn't surprised by things. He doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't have character flaws. He's a perfect being. That's part of the definition of God. And so all those are analytic statements, in that the predicate is contained in the subject. Now, how about, let me give you one more. See if you can see anything about this. Let's see. The president is the chief legislator of the United States. Or how about this? The president is the chief. So is that analytic or is it synthetic?
Synthetic.
He's the top lawmaker.
You might have to research that in order to find that out. I mean, most
of them, so. Because he doesn't even.
So this would still be analytic. Is it true or false?
Well, it could be vetoed, I guess. So.
Yeah.
Can the president write laws?
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
He's
going to sign off on this. That's a bad man. How about if I said the president is the head of the legislative branch of the government? Head of the legislative branch of the U.S. So this would still be analytic, but it's false. So you can have a false analytic statement. It doesn't mean that it's any less analytic. What about the president's commander-in-chief of the armed forces?
It's true.
That's true, and also analytic, right? So an analytic statement can be false. Like you can have a triangle is a four-sided figure. Analytic, false. So analytic just means that the if it's true, the predicate's contained in the subject. If it's false, then it's actually it's a contradiction. It's something that has to be false. But so an analytic statement doesn't necessarily have to be true any more than a synthetic statement does. But if it's true, it means the predicate is contained implicitly in the subject. If it's false, it's a contradiction. This thing about the head of the legislative branch, I suppose this one's kind of funky here, but because it's not written outright, maybe an outright contradiction. But it's also a definition. So analytic statements are definitions of things. Also mathematical, well, math could say logic. Let's say definitions and logic. Synthetic. Synthetic statements where what?
The predicate is not.
The predicate is not contained in the subject. So what would be an example of a synthetic statement?
Cedric over there is a Eastman.
John is a bachelor.
Wait, what was the example?
Jeffrey Burr there is a teacher.
Okay. So, Baby is a teacher. So this is kind of interesting because the subject is a person here. So what is it? So is this part of the definition of me, a person? Does me being a teacher define me? You know, do persons have essence? This gets really philosophical, right?
Where's your substance?
Do you have an essence? I think what, now, could contrast that with JD is a man or human or something like that, right?
What about you, Rock?
That'd be synthetic, right?
That's what's called the necessary truth. I think, like, as a teacher, it's sort of what philosophers call an accidental feature of me. It's something that doesn't have to be true about me. And it's not really true about, this doesn't really define me. It's just a fact about me. So it's a fact about me that I went to teaching as a career. Now, the fact that I'm human defines me, right? Because part of what makes me, me, is that I'm a human being. Yeah.
Now, based on the argument that you're laying down, your example in the book that John is a bachelor would seem to be very similar to you being a teacher.
Right. Yeah.
I have a question about this.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you put, like, the word professor in front of JB, Professor JB is a teacher, then that automatically makes it analytic. And then, for example, Mr. JB as a man would be, because it's the predicate is contained in the subject, I mean, that...
Well, if you say a professor...
That's kind of like implied, or like
a professor is a teacher. I'm not sure that's actually true, but I think it would be. It's presented at that would be an analytic statement, right? If you say a professor does academic work or something, that would be analytic and it'd be true.
So you're just saying, just based upon the fact that just because you're a professor doesn't necessarily mean you're actually currently teaching at that moment. For example, you're just qualified to teach. Is that really like what?
Well, they have like, I mean, there's, you gotta be a retired professor, or they have what they call non-teaching faculty here that just like do other stuff at the college, like a bunch of administrative work or counseling. You are part of the faculty.
So there's just too much open for, like, I guess, interpretation to be an analytic statement, I guess.
Well, just to, like, a clear example would be, to maybe stick with some clear examples, like analytic, a bachelor is an unmarried man. That's an analytic statement because that's what defines a bachelor. In the same way, a teacher is one who instructs students, say. That would be an analytic statement.
That is.
But, I teach in Oregon, you know, or Jeffrey Bardale teaches in Oregon, it's not analytic, it's synthetic, because it's just a fact about me.
Exactly, okay.
Yeah.
So, if you did, Jimmy's a teacher in Oregon now, or currently, or is that still synthetic?
Well, I could still, I'd say I could still, that would still be synthetic. Because I can still be me and do something else. Suppose I blow this popsicle stand and become a great filmmaker, right? And I'm making movies and writing screenplays. I'd still be me. I'd just be doing something else. But if you if you hit me over the head and put me into like a mulcher and maybe into fertilizer for your garden. Right, then I wouldn't be me anymore, right? And you'd say, "Oh, look," so the statement, Professor Bardale is mulch. I wouldn't be me anymore. I would say there would be no more me. So you can't. One thing about like an essential property that describes an analytic statement, it's something that you couldn't really change it, and it would still be the same thing. Like a triangle can't go from being a three-sided figure to a four-sided figure. Being a three-sided figure is what defines a triangle. In the same way, I can't go from being a man, like a human, into being like a chair, right? Otherwise, or mulch. Otherwise, I don't exist anymore. I pass out of existence. Yeah.
So at what point in your example do you cease to be you?
Probably when I go into the mulcher. Or what's that? Maybe when my brain goes and when I lose consciousness, I don't know.
Maybe when you get struck over the head.
Yeah, it depends on how hard you hit me, I guess. Right.
So the difference here is like me being a person, you know, being a man or a person is an essential quality, because that's, you know, that this defines Jeffrey Barville as the name of a person. Whereas me being a teacher is just an accidental property. I could have done a bunch of other things, right? It's not just the case that I could do something now, but in the past I could have chosen some other career path. Or I could have, you know, dropped out and lived in a cabin in the Maine woods and not done anything except, you know, I might live off the land and not taken an occupation at all. So we have analytic statements, which are true by definition, definitions of things, logic, and then you have synthetic statements, which are just statements about things. Now, how does this work into analytic and synthetic in Hume? To start out with Hume for contrast. So, analytic statement a priori. Are there statements like that that are analytic and a priori? So, in other words, the predicates contain the subject and its. Predicates contain the subject and it's something that you know independent of the senses.
Really?
Yeah, so. He calls these relations of ideas. And then, let's see, I think I got that on there, right? Oh, maybe I don't have that on there.
He has a logic definition.
Yeah. And he includes so logic, definition, and mathematics. And then the synthetic statements he calls matters of fact and existence. So matters of fact and existence, he thinks, they're all synthetic. That if you want to find out what exists in the world, you have to use your senses. If you want to know the facts, you have to use your senses. If you want to know how ideas are related to one another, use your reason. So, reason and senses, right? So now are there any analytic truths that you can know through reason according to Hume? Then, are there any synthetic truths that you can know? Sorry, did I get that right? I didn't get that. Are there any definitions you can know through observation? And you will say no. And then are there any a priori truths which are synthetic? And he also says no. So if you want to know about ideas, use your reason. If you want to know about the world, use your senses. Ideas, use your mind. The world or what exists, the facts about the world, use your senses. They're pretty straightforward. Now, there's a bunch of other stuff that Hume says. It's kind of crazy. But if you look at this just as a map of how you find out about the world, if you want to know how ideas relate to one another, just see how they're associated. If you want to know about math, you use your mind. If you want to know about what temperature water boils at, do an experiment, right? Use your senses. If you want to find out whether King Arthur existed, look through the history books, look at personal reports, dig where King Arthur was supposed to have been, look around and see if there's any castle that might be Camelot, right? And you do some investigation. You don't sit there and think about the concept of King Arthur and think about the concept of Lancelot and think about the concept of England. You have to go out there in the world and look around. Yeah. On the other hand, if you want to figure out, you're trying to figure out some calculus problem, you don't go and do a bunch of experiments. You go write some equations and try to figure it out, just using your mind. Okay, so now this is Hume's view. So Kant comes along, and how does Kant change this?
He adds mathematics and presuppositions of science.
So where does he want to put math?
Synthetic.
Why is math synthetic?
Because of contradictions, or
you can find. It looks like you can find the answer in multiple different ways.
Oh yeah, that's
at least that's what my understanding was.
Kind of like you can come up with the same answer like by going different avenues.
Yeah, like it's like 5 plus 7 equals 12, but you could also move 6 plus 6, 6 times 2, 3 times 4, for all different reasons, or different ways to get to 12, it just wasn't that one.
Yeah, so you think about the concept, the definition of 12. You could say, well, 12 is 5 plus 7, but 12 is also 11 minus 1. No. So, you know, there's an infinite
that's
number.
That's
10.
Sorry, 13 minus 1.
Plus.
So this isn't math, so I'll...
It's a boneheaded error. It gets you every time. So, at least I'm not miscalculating trillions of dollars as in the president's new budget. I just make a simple arithmetic errors. I'm not involved in fantastical projections about matters of fact and existence. So, okay, so you have an infinite number of predicates that can apply to 12, right? 12 can be, you know, 12 can be, you could just say 12 is, you know, 13 minus 1, 14 minus 1, 15 minus 1, 16 minus 1, you could just go to infinity, right? So there's an infinite number of predicates that would apply to the number 12. So therefore, it doesn't really make sense, he thinks, to say this is analytic. It's synthetic. So that's one kind of a minor change. But I think the other thing that Kant puts in here, which are really important, which is what do we have here?
Presuppositions of science
and math.
Presuppositions of science. And what are some of those presuppositions
of like
science?
That kind of
science. So cause and effect is chief among them. So what does he mean by the presupposition of science? Like what? What is a presupposition?
Like a hypothesis? Or like a, something you it's a presume you presume that it's true, like.
Yeah, so it's an assumption you make. So hypothesis is something where you're just sort of, I suppose you're assuming it temporarily, and then you're going to see whether it's true or not. You're going to try to verify it. This is more like a presupposition. Is more like
an expectation, more like.
No, that's more of like something where you think, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Let's try to see. Think about a presupposition is something you assume as a basic axiom that you don't. It's not something you're trying to prove. Yeah.
That'd be like 2 + 2 = 4. So you take two objects and put together.
That's kind of treating 2 + 2 = 4 like an experiment. Kant says that math is still a priori, but it's synthetic.
So in the presupposition of science, what he's saying is like Moore's law. You assume the doubling of computer power every 2 years.
I think that's
where it's not backed up completely by science, but you know, could we take from those things? Is that what that
is? I think he would say that is that would be a that would go here. That's a sort of experimental because it's based on patterns.
Is it the expectation of the cause?
No.
Or yeah, the effect of the effect. Like in other words, like you know, you mix these two chemicals together, then you know that.
It's not just an expectation, though. He says it's something that you know through reason. Yeah.
Is it like a foundation so that you can build upon the next assumption?
Yeah, right. It's a foundation. It's like like Descartes' axiom. So an axiom is something you assume, and you don't try to prove it through something else. So, for example, okay, suppose you have the, I can't remember if I used this example in the book or not, but you have these, people notice these distant stars, and they'd be doing this weird wobbling. It's like you look at them, and they sort of be going back and forth. You're like, what's going on with that? Like we measure the light, and it would just, it would look like the star was wobbling back and forth. And it didn't fit in with any of our theories of what stars are supposed to do. How can a star wobble? It's a giant flaming ball of gas.
And planets like pulling their gravitational...
Well, what it turned out was there was actually two stars, and they're rotating around each other. And it's like called a binary star system.
Series A and Series B.
Wobble, and then you get the binary star system. So what happens is we saw the wobbling star, and then we got a better look at it. We said, oh, it's not really wobbling. It's two stars that are going around each other. And then from a distance, because the brightness sort of diffuses it, and because we can't have a good resolution in our telescopes, it looks like the star's wobbling. Suppose before we figured out it was a binary star, and maybe somebody suggests, hey, I have a theory, maybe it's a binary star system, maybe that's what explains the wobble. And we don't have any better telescopes, and suppose our telescopes aren't giving us the answer. Suppose another scientist says, well, maybe just sort of the star wobbles for no reason. What would be the reaction of that person? Maybe stars just sort of wobble. That's just kind of what they do.
They laugh.
Yeah.
No reason.
So is that more like Higgs boson or dark matter? Is that kind of thing? Where...
Yeah, like Sirius A and Sirius B, and they're like a sister star just like that, which one is, you can't see it because it's dark matter, like you were saying.
Or into a lot of abstruse physics stuff that I might be losing to people. So let's just stick with the two star. You see a star as wobbling. One person says, I have a theory. Maybe instead of the star wobbling, what's really going on, it's one star rotating around another star, and it just looks like it's wobbling to us. And the other person says, well, maybe just sometimes stars wobble for no apparent reason. And the person says, well, do you mean there's something special about this star? Why doesn't our sun wobble? And the person says, well, no, I'm not saying the star is any different than our sun. I'm just saying that our sun doesn't wobble and this one does. And that's just the way it is. And there's no reason for it. That person wouldn't really be a scientist, right? Scientists, what do scientists do?
Find the causes and stuff.
Yeah, they define causes. They're trying to find out why did things happen this way. And part of that is giving causal explanations. Why is it wobbling? And you don't say, well, it's wobbling for no reason. That's an anti-science view. And it's especially anti-science to say that our sun is exactly this, might be exactly the same as this distant star, and it wobbles and our sun doesn't. You think if there's a difference between two stars, one wobbles and one, or if one star wobbles, the other one doesn't, there has to be some difference which explains why you get a different outcome. In other words, if you get different effects, you assume there has to be different causes. To assume exactly the same causes and different effects, again, is an anti-science view. So to be a scientist at all means you have to start out assuming a belief in cause and effect. You have to assume that certain causes produce certain effects, that every event has a cause. And so so cause and effect, the knowledge of cause and effect, we put that as a statement, every event has a cause. So instead of thinking, well, sometimes things just happen, you say, no, there's got to be an explanation. And that's the scientific view. Now, how's that different from, you know, so every event has a cause. Why is that? Well, I ask this question, is this analytic or synthetic?
Analytic.
Anybody else? Who says analytic?
It says here that it's synthetic.
Yeah, it's Kant says it's synthetic. Now, what if, contrast this with every effect as a cause. So this one says every effect has a cause. This one says every event has a cause. Now, every effect has a cause. Is that analytic or synthetic?
Yeah, you just have to have a cause for there to be an effect.
So this is analytic, right? Because
what is implied.
Yeah, what is an effect? What's the definition of effect?
The result of a cause.
And what's a cause?
An event.
A cause is something that produces an effect, right? An effect is something that happens because of a cause. So cause and effect are, you know, analytically related to one another. An effect is that which is produced by cause. A cause is that which produces an effect, by definition. But every event has a cause. That's not analytic. That's saying something substantial about the world. You're saying everything that happens, happens for some reason. And there's some explanation for whatever happens, even if we might not know what it is. That every event is caused by some other, every event has some cause to it, which explains why it happened the way it did, as opposed to some other way. And so that is, so this is a substantial fact about the universe. It's something which is, it's a fact about the universe. It's not just true by definition. It's not one of these trivial truths like, you know, a bachelor's an unmarried male. It's a substantial truth about the universe, but it's known through pure reason concepts. Questions or comments so far? This is kind of heady stuff here. Yeah.
So with the event thing, like the differentiating those two, like, would that be like maybe most easily, I guess, envisioned by just by using a human being as an example? Like, it's, they just come up with an idea to do something, like, it, for no reason at all, they just decide they want to do something. I mean, is that idea, I mean, there was nothing that really caused it, you know what I mean? Like, so let's say you just, I don't know, I can't really think of an exact scenario, but in other words, like just a random idea that comes into your mind. I mean, there's nothing that caused it, but it's an event. I mean,
yeah, people are kind of difficult because there's a whole debate about free will. Do you have free will? And if human beings have free will, then you know they're the cause of their actions, or the, or outside causes don't compel them to do what they do.
So you're basically in effect saying we are the cause in that particular case.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they would say that human beings can be causes, but they are not themselves cause to do what they do, if you believe in free will.
So can you give an example of like an event that without a cause, like just something appearing in the middle of the universe, like out of nowhere? I mean, like... I mean, Big Bang can't be really explained by quantum physics and quantum mechanics, but yet they still rely on that as being like the cornerstone of, you know, where we all came from. So how do they...
Well, I don't think that... I mean... I don't think the view is that it had no cause at all. I mean, a cosmologist won't say, yeah, you know, at the beginning of time, there was nothing and then something happened. Or first there was nothing and then there was something for no apparent reason. They'd say, well, we just don't know what the cause of the universe is. Or maybe they'd say the universe has just always been here. That's the other thing you could say. If the universe has just always been here, then there's no need to explain its cause. But you know,
kind of a cop out answer. I mean, that's the whole like thing that drives most people, and that, you know, I mean, just to be like, oh yeah, well, you can keep going and trying, but you're never going to explain it. It just is. You know,
well, I mean, a lot of people will say, oh well, the universe has to have a cause, therefore God must have created it. Then you say, well, who created God? And you say, well, that doesn't make any sense. God's just always been here. And so why can't you just say the universe has just always been here? If it's, in other words, you might say, well, just the world's just always been here in a different form. This is more of a topic for theories of reality. You talk about arguments for God's existence. But you get the basic idea that science is the quest for explanations. And when people do science, when you just start to investigate and just, again, take like a concrete problem, like, and you could be anything from, you know, what causes the diabetes, what causes cancer, I think of some other example, what's something, what, I mean, even this idea of what causes people to get infections and die, and they figure it out, in the 19th century that if you wash your hands before digging around somebody's guts, you know, that they wouldn't die of an infection after the operation. Usually what would happen, particularly during the Civil War, is you'd have people were operated on, and the guy would just go from patient to patient. He never washed his hands. And you'd have all these people dying of massive infections because the doctors didn't wash their hands. And so we came up with a germ theory of disease to explain why people, you know, got infections and what infections were. So to figure out, you know, to go looking for the reason why people die after you take the bullet out of their wound, you patch them up, they seem fine, but for some reason the tissue got like discolored and the person got really sick and they died. Why did that happen? You're assuming there's a cause. And you're assuming if you find out what the cause is, you can do something and you might be able to keep the person from dying. And so to start looking for that cause in the first place, you're already assuming cause and effect. And so to actually do science requires you to presuppose there is such a thing as cause and effect. And that's Kant's basic point, that you can't prove cause and effect. You have to assume it as a basic principle of reason. And since you can't prove it from the senses, but you know it, you must know it through reason. And he thinks that you wouldn't be able to do science without presupposing cause and effect. And that shows that you have some sort of rational, again, going back to Descartes, a rational intuition of cause and effect. That you just know intuitively that when you get something unusual happen, that there has to be some unusual cause. That if everything's been the same, you know, if a pattern is continued for a long time and then it changes, there has to be a different cause to explain the different effect. And Kant says that's not something you can observe with your senses, but you still know it. How do you know it? Through reason. So therefore it has to be an a priori knowledge. I suppose you might say it goes back to innate ideas. Kant would say there are innate structures in the human mind which allow you to recognize that every event has a cause. And it's not something you observe with your senses, it's something you intuitively know. And I'm using intuition in kind of a rational sense, not in the sort of woo-woo sense. But it's something that's inherent part of the structures of your mind that you're able to recognize that every event has a cause. It's something you just know. And it's not something you can prove from the senses. So that's the rationalism part of Kant. So every event has a cause. This idea that the universe has, you know, laws of cause and effect that are pretty much the same throughout, that, you know, the gases in the sun and on distant stars obey the same cosmological laws. That's also an assumption of science. That if you dig up a bit of copper, you know, in Africa, it's going to have the same properties as a bit of copper that you dig up in the United States, and that the laws of electricity, you know, are going to work pretty much the same anywhere, and so on. Now, sometimes there's, you know, different conditions, and then you might get different effects. But given the same conditions, the same substances will interact in the same basic ways. That's, again, a presupposition of science. Questions or comments? Yeah?
I got a question on the every event has a cause. I feel like it's just wordplay. What makes event different from effect if you need an event you need a cause for an event to happen?
So an event is just something that happens. So and it doesn't assume that it has a cause or not.
So there's no reason behind an event happening?
Yeah, the concept of an event is just of something happening, or of, I don't know, what is an event? It's, you know, a state of affairs changing over time or something. It would be like the definition of an event. But it doesn't assume as part of the definition of an event that it has cause.
So like, for example, like what? I mean, you get a flat tire, but it wasn't because you ran over something sharp, or because your tire had too much pressure, or because you,
yeah,
you know, it just happened? Like, there's no real reason?
Well, I mean, it's, most people think that every event has a cause, but the question is that part of the definition of an event? So, I think of something that's universally true, but not true by definition. Here's one. So, it's true that every creature with a heart also has a liver, or say kidneys. So it's creature. So every creature with a heart also has kidneys. But that doesn't mean that creature with a heart and creature with kidneys mean the same thing, even though they pick out exactly the same class of animals. So if I said, you know, creatures with hearts, and you'd get a long list over here. I said creatures with kidneys, you get a long list here. They'd be exactly the same animals in the list, but they have different meanings. And so most people think every event has a cause is true. But then the question is it true by definition?
In other words, how can you prove that, right? Is that kind of like what you're saying?
No, it's whether it's just something which is factually true or this is something that has to be true or is true by definition. So, and this is kind of a subtle distinction, but it's a distinction between something which couldn't possibly be false just by the definitions. So, you know, A equals A. That's something that couldn't possibly be false. A thing is identical with itself. Or a thing is not identical with its opposite. Not A. A is not equivalent to not A. So these are you know, basic truths of logic. Now, if you have something else like... what's something that could be different? How about like,
is it that cause has no tie to event, like effect does with cause? Is that essentially what it is? Like, for there to be a cause, there has to be an effect in that sense. You think when someone says cause, you think effect.
Because it's right? In the definition.
A priori, you know, the definition of an effect is that which is produced by a cause.
Right. And that.
So it's impossible for an effect to happen without being produced by cause.
Right.
By definition.
Yeah, exactly, by definition. And the word event has nothing to do with cause.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Take an example of something. How about it rains a lot in Eugene? So, it rains a lot in Eugene. So that's true, right? Was that true by definition? So it's not part of the concept of Eugene. And what if, like, in, you know, suppose there really is global warming, and suppose in 300 years maybe Eugene will be bone dry, right? Maybe it'll be like Eastern Oregon, and it'll be like the Mojave Desert. You know, you don't know what the future's gonna bring. So it's not that would Eugene cease to be Eugene? No, the city still might be here.
Underwater
still,
about 300 feet.
Well, not if it's the globe. Well, I suppose, yeah, the ocean tries or something like that. You see what I mean? It wouldn't change what the city is just because it rains less. So, whereas as event here just means something happens, effect means a cause did it. And so this is analytic because it's true by definition that every effect has to have a cause, because an effect is just that which produces, produced by a cause. It's true that every cause produces an effect, because that's what a cause is. But to say every event has a cause says that everything that happens, happens for a reason. And the reason is there were some previous set of events or forces which caused it to occur the way it did. It's not true by just a trivial truth that's true by definition where you're just unpacking definitions. It's a substantial truth about the world. But it's not something you know through your senses. It's something you know through reason, a priori. Yeah.
So what does define Eugene, where it's at, or who's in it? Or
I guess like the geographic area or something like that, the city limits. I mean, it doesn't say that it can't grow or shrink, but like the general geographic area or something, I think defines like what a city is. A city is defined by pieces of geography. I suppose you might say the city government or something like that. Maybe there's some ambiguity in names of places, whether you're talking about institutional government or whether you're talking about just a piece of land. And that might be a little, that those concepts might be a little muddy. Mm-hmm. But you know, whether you're talking about either one, the fact that it rains, which I think picks out more of the geography, isn't an essential fact about this particular land mass. So this belief in cause and effect, how does this solve the problems we ran into with Hume? What's Kant up to here?
He's basically saying there has to be a cause for the effect, right, and an effect for after each cause. And whereas Hume was just saying that isn't necessarily, like, if the brick is thrown at the window, doesn't mean that it's going to break the window, for example.
Yeah, Hume says you don't know that every event has a cause. Why don't you know that every event has a cause? Well, according to Hume, why don't you know?
Anything.
What's that?
Because he can imagine anything.
Yeah, you can imagine it. There's no necessary connection. So why isn't there a necessary connection between cause and effect then? Why does Hume reject that there is a necessary connection between cause and effect?
Everything imaginable is possible.
Right, everything imaginable is possible. There's a reason why there's an important reason why Hume rejects the necessary connection between cause and effect. Remember, that's part of three. There are three parts of cause and effect.
The lessonness of it happening, the third part. The
third part, right, the necessary connection.
The anticipation.
Why does he accept the first two, the priority and time? He says that's okay, and he says that the contiguity, that the objects have to touch, that's okay, but he rejects necessary connection. What's Hume's philosophy?
So that there's a period where you assume that there's a feeling of anticipation before the item connects, where anything could happen, and you assume that the following event will happen.
Yeah, but just what's Hume's overall philosophy? Is he a rationalist or an empiricist?
There's no real reason to believe that the next thing's going to happen if there's no empirical evidence for it to happen.
What is empirical evidence?
You can't sense it happening. Or
there you go, the senses, right? Yeah, so Hume says that you can observe priority and time, A happens and then B happens. You can observe that with your senses. You can observe with your senses that the objects have to touch, or that the objects do touch before the cause and the effect, they have to touch for the effect to happen. But then the third part, the necessary connection, that's not something you can observe with your senses. So therefore, he rejects it. Why? Because he's an empiricist. Empiricists say that if you know something, it has to come through the senses. If you can't point to a sensation of necessity, you have to reject the necessary connection between cause and effect. Now Kant comes along and he solves this problem by rejecting empiricism. He says, no, all knowledge does not come from the senses, that you through pure reason you know that every event has a cause, and therefore that it's true that the necessity and cause and effect is, I mean, in a way it's sort of in your mind, but it's also out there in the world. And so what Kant says is that you know cause and effect exists even though you can't sense it. So therefore, you know, instead of getting rid of this idea of causation, just get rid of empiricism. Empiricism is wrong in this respect. Because you do know, you know, commonsensically, that cause and effect is real. How do you know it? You know it through pure reason. It's a presupposition of science. You know it a priori. Even though it's a synthetic proposition about the world, it's not just some trivial definition, it's something that you know. You know there is such a thing as cause and effect. If you can't prove it by your senses, you must know it through reason. So that's the rationalist part of Kant. And then after that, he generally follows like an empiricist model and thinks that you know, the senses are really important. But this idea that every event has a cause is known a priori is a big difference between him and Hume. And that's why he doesn't end up with these absurd consequences that you see in Berkeley and Hume.
So does he believe in the material world?
Yes. So let's get to that. So how do you know a material world exists? And here, Kant makes this distinction between, noumena and phenomena. Again, two important terms for the exam. Noumena, Kant calls the thing in itself, and phenomena is the thing as such, which he really means as humanly experienced. So Kant says that, coming back to this problem of how do we know there's a material world? We have all these experiences, and then we suppose, if we're Locke, that there's this material world out there that's the cause of them. And Kant, again, accepts that sort of as a rational intuition, that there is a real world out there. But then the question is, how do we know that the world out there matches up with our sensations? How do we know that what's in here, you know, matches what's out there? And Kant, again, has a sort of a compromise position where he says, you can never know reality in itself. All you can know is reality as humanly experienced. What you should do is just study reality as humanly experienced and make a bunch of generalizations about the way we experience the world and what the world, the actual world, would have to be like for us to have these experiences, and then call that knowledge. So you sort of lower the bar for knowledge, where you say, let's give up understanding the world in itself. We know certain things about the real world, or the world, the noumena. We know that the noumena is that which produces our experience. We know that the noumena is something different than the way we experience the world. We know that there's something like cause and effect out there. We know that there are objects out there. And that's pretty much all we can know about the world in itself. We can't really know what reality, unperceived and uninterpreted, would be like. But what we can know is we can know the way we experience the world. And so what we need to do is focus on the phenomena, that we have certain basic ways in which we interpret the world. We think about things in terms of objects and their properties. We think about events causing other events. We think about things in terms of quantity and quality and all these basic categories of human perception. Those are all kind of like, those are things that our brain does to try to interpret reality. They're not part of reality in itself. And the problem is that we can't step outside of ourselves and look at ourselves and look at the world and see how they sort of work together and see how our brain interprets reality. We're stuck inside our skulls. We're stuck inside our brains. And so therefore, we can never know what the world is like uninterpreted by the human brain, unperceived by the human senses. And
because
so
we change it every, like, as we receive it, it's changed by the way. Is that what you're saying? Like, is that kind of like the idea behind it? Like, it may be manipulated slightly, but because of your maybe preconceptions or like things in your mind that make it relatable to you. Like,
well, it's not even just like individual preconceptions. It's just by being a human being. So think about color, right? So why do you see objects as colored? Well, part of it is there's something out there in the real world. It's the wavelengths of light, and certain wavelengths of light create certain sensations in us. Right? Locke's secondary properties are like this. Objects don't really have color, but we have color receptors, which create certain experiences in our mind when the real properties of objects bounce this wavelength of light into our eyes. So Kant thinks that all of our perceptions and beliefs about the world are sort of like these secondary qualities. They're like color, in that there's something out there which is real, which is causing us to have these sensations, but the sensations themselves aren't real. So objects really aren't colored, but they create color sensations in us. In the same way, all of our perceptions and all of our conceptions of the world are colored by the way we both perceive and conceive of the world. also our five senses, and also the categories of human thought, the ways in which we interpret the world, create the reality we experience. And there's no way of getting outside of the human experience, of human perceptions, human senses, and human categories of thinking in order to see how it matches up with the real world. So Kant says what we should do is give up the dream of the philosophers to pierce the veil of appearances and get to reality and just recognize that there is a real world out there. We know that there is through rational intuition, but we also know through reason that there's no way to perceive it directly. We can only have indirect access to it. And so this indirect access, the world as humanly experienced, we'll just call that knowledge, and we'll make some generalizations about it, and we'll study it, and we can categorize and systematize human experience and learn how we experience the world and what the world would have to be like in order for us to have these experiences. And that, to Kant, is what knowledge is all about. So we'll talk more about this on Wednesday and also review for the exam, which will open Wednesday after class.